Hold on. I don't know what's going on here. There it goes. All right. Caleb, are you back, Caleb?
I'm back.
All right. We're all here.
Tech tard over here.
Okay. Right. No, that's fine. Yeah, Caleb's having a little bit of Mac problems today, so.
Wait, back problems after all that camping?
No, Mac.
Mac problems.
Mac problems, yeah.
No, I'm over the back problems, but.
Okay.
Oh, okay. Well, that's good. So how do, Caleb, how do you know Ian?
I actually don't. I know a guy he works with, though.
Ah, so I wondered how you got, you know. I've never tried to get an interview with any creators. You're our first, actually.
Oh, really?
Yeah, we've been a little over.
I'm going to ruin it for everybody. Yeah. You're going to be like,
oh. Well, we've been recording for a little over a year. We just never, I don't know why we didn't. I guess I just didn't think we were worthy enough. I'm not sure.
Chris, talk to anybody. It's not a just. You just got to ask.
Yeah. Well, that's what we're starting to do. So.
Yeah. Yeah, Phil was very. Phil spoke very highly of you, and.
Yeah, Phil's great.
Yeah, he's a great guy. I've known him for about probably going on 10 or 11 years now. So.
Cool.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Okay, so basically, I'm already recording just because of, you know, I've had issues in the past, but we'll do a little intro and then, and a one, and a two, and welcome to the Tales from the Long Box podcast. This is episode 57, a chat with Ian Brill. I am Chris Mosby.
I'm Caleb Gerard.
And I'm Murray Fox.
And today we have our first comic creator interview or chat or random talk, you know, however you want to say it, and with Ian Brill, who's go ahead.
Hey, guys.
Hello.
Hey, it's nice to have you on the show. Our first interview.
Well, you're not including the podcaster guys, but yeah.
Well, yeah, but they're just podcasters like us. I, you know, that's good point.
I'm actually contributing to society in my own way.
Yes. Appreciate that. Speaking of that, I'm
beyond looking... comic books? How is that possible?
That's the only way I can justify it to myself.
Oh.
It's a lie, but I'll fight on that lie, as they say in The Wire.
Wire fan. Okay, I've already become a fan of yours just for that. Okay.
Sure. Wait, yeah, you're in Maryland, right?
No, I'm in Phoenix, actually, just outside of Phoenix.
Okay.
Yeah.
I saw your email thinks in Maryland, but I know Philip's from there.
Yeah, we're from all I'm in, well, right now anyway. That's in 3 weeks it'll change. But I'm in Tupelo, Mississippi. And
awesome.
We have Murray from somewhere in deepest, darkest Canada.
Wait, where in Canada?
Waterloo, near Toronto.
Okay, I'm sort of obsessed with Canada, and here's why. You know, I like time travel stories. I like alternate reality stories. If everyone,
and that's Canada, isn't it?
If anyone is interested, you know, in an alternate reality story, what if America never fought the Revolutionary War? We have that story, and it's Canada, which I've been to Toronto. I've enjoyed it.
Interesting.
I pronounced. Yeah, I've been there to the Fan Expo. You go to the Fan Expo, right?
I do. I just got back last weekend. Wow.
It's a ton of fun. I am obsessed with a place that is almost I guess Toronto feels this way. That's almost America, but sort of not. I think in its own place, and it's great. And this is a bunch of crappy references that you're going to hate, but I do have a lot of appreciation for Rush. I love that band. Kiefer Sutherland is seen a lot in sort of near where I am in Los Angeles. He's, of course, the grandson, I believe, of Tommy Douglas, who's maybe one of the most. The fact that I know who Tommy Douglas is makes me huge to Canadians, but I find the whole place just fascinating. I'll tell you what, I actually have Stitcher, the iPhone app that allows you to listen to radio from all over. And I sometimes listen to the Canadian classic rock because every classic rock station in America, I can tell you their pull list without even listening to the station. But Canada, due to your Canadian content laws,
yes,
40% of it has to be Canadian bands. So they changed up. So you get an April Wine. You get
That's interesting.
April Wine, another Rush. I don't know if you've claimed Alice Cooper as a Canadian band yet, but you probably should.
No, we claim him in Arizona. You cannot have Alice Cooper.
I don't know. He broke big in Toronto before I think he broke big in America, so they've got a shot.
Well, we're the cutting edge.
There's also the argument, why would anybody claim Alice Cooper, but, you know, but...
Arizona. Yeah, it's Arizona, Ian. Come on.
Sure.
What else we got?
Do you ever go
to that? He wasn't bad on that Muppet episode.
Oh, I have that on tape.
He's almost a Muppet himself, right?
Totally. Yeah,
pretty much.
Yeah. He fits right in.
Okay.
I wanted to announce that I'm writing the new Alice Cooper comic. That's why I mentioned all that stuff. No, I'm just...
Okay.
Although there were some Alice Cooper comics, though. So.
Yes, there was. I remember seeing those.
Marvel, I think, weren't they?
It was Marvel. There was a Marvel 70s one, and then there was, like, Neil Gaiman wrote one in, like, the 90s.
No kidding. Really? Wow. You could do an Alice Cooper bio of sorts.
Not a bio. It would be like those Kiss comics where, like, Alice Cooper gets into some adventure.
When he has superpowers, like when Joe Casey was writing Kiss. Okay, cool.
Yeah. Have you ever seen that huge... This is crazy. Again, okay, I'm a fan of a lot of podcasts. I love it when we go off on tangents. And we'll get to all the freelancers, Jack the World Order, the stuff that people care about, I guess. But,
okay.
I was once in a Barnes & Noble's, and I saw this giant Kiss comic, this hardcover that's like those it's like those Marvel omnibuses. I have a few where it's, you know, it's a hardcover and it's a, you know, 2,000 pages, whatever. It's all the Kiss comics from they, you know, they've been through 100 publishers, so it has the Marvel one, it has all the Image ones, you know, they were at Platinum for a while, and now they have a book from IDW, and this has all of them. But the one weird thing is it's clearly just scanned copies of the old comics, up to and including the fact that they have the company's former logos. Like if you picked up a Conan trade from Dark Horse that reprints the Marvel stuff, they reprint everything except the Marvel logo, because that's the one thing that's still owned by Marvel. The only thing, like, Image Comics famously only owns one piece of IP, which is the Image logo. But Kiss, this book was just shat out there. So they just... Can we swear on this, by the way? I'm sorry.
Totally.
Yeah, go ahead.
Now,
this book was...
I don't even think anybody's listening to this podcast, so it's okay. No, I'm just kidding.
And so they just scanned, like the, you know, the first, you know, the all the covers of the Image comics, and they did, and every company. So they still have the logo and everything, which is... I don't know, technically actionable, but yeah. You know, they don't care. So it's just like this cheap, and I want to know who bought, you know, it's $125, who knows. But like, of all these Kiss comics, I mean, I don't know. Those first three records are okay, by the way, but that's about it when it comes to Kiss.
Yeah, I just looked up on Comic Book DB, he did write an issue, or co-wrote, I'm sure, an issue of Marvel Premiere. I just sent you guys a link.
Oh, the Alice Cooper one? Yeah. That was him, and I want to say Ed Hannigan on art?
Yeah, actually it was.
Was it Steven Gerber? Because I know Steven Gerber wrote the Kiss comic.
Let's see. Ed Hannigan was one of the writers, it says.
Oh, okay.
The penciler was Tom S. Sutton.
Oh, yeah, he would be. He did all those Star Trek
stuff. Yeah,
that is a 1979 talent lineup. I love that era of Marvel.
Yeah, that wasn't too bad.
I still love, you would not have, as I wrote on the Dracula World Order blog, you would not have Dracula World Order without Tomb of Dracula, which is a book I love.
I was looking at your doing research on you. I was looking at your Dracula World Order Tumblr thing, and I saw the Tomb of Dracula number 54 with the Son of Dracula cover.
That's
you had
right.
listed.
That's not where I ripped off the idea of Son of Dracula. I ripped off from California. Yeah.
Yeah. Not didn't rip that off at all. Right. Exactly.
I ripped that off from either Castlevania or Harry Nilsson.
Yeah. speaking of Dracula World Order, I read it. I got it. I bought it out of Comicology maybe about an hour ago. I read it.
Oh, awesome. Thank you.
And I have to say, I'm not, you know, as anybody that's listening to the show knows, I'm not a big vampire fan. But I love the concept of that book. I really do. With the whole, you know, 1% thing. Yeah, I actually enjoyed it.
Well, yeah, if it's one of the things, if you're into vampire books, the book's got you covered. If you're not into it, but if you're into books about, I don't know, horror, that horror concepts that speak somewhat, that's informed by the real world,
right.
It's also got that too. So, you know, I mean, I love, you know, I love whether it's the George Romero stuff, where it's a zombie thing, but then it's informed by real world neuroses. I think that gives a great charge to the stories.
Oh,
and
yeah.
It's definitely when I'm crafting a story for myself, and you know, Dracula World Order is my own book. I own it. And then I'm interested in that, where it's, we're taking real world fears, and then we're putting it through the, I don't know, it's being interpreted by me, a guy who watches it, who owns a Monster Squad t-shirt. So it's that kind of thing.
Oh, wow. That's cool. Love that movie.
Oh, yeah. I love that film. Also, Night of the Creeps, which is directed by the same guy, Fred Decker.
Oh, I haven't heard of that one. Interesting.
Oh, you guys, see Night of the Creeps. Tom Atkins, who is great in Escape from New York, and who is also in Halloween 3. He is amazing in Night of the Creeps. That is the role of his career. I cannot recommend that film enough.
Interesting.
You are a font of a cool little tidbits here, man.
I watch a lot of movies. For a while I tried to watch a movie a day, but
okay.
Then the writing stuff, thankfully, got
so
me
so you me. You're an LA boy, so you and I'm not certain of your age, but when I was
I'm 29.
Wow. You're 29. So you were not around when Elvira was doing her weekly C-level horror movies on Saturday nights in Los Angeles. Okay.
No, unfortunately, I was not around for the era of horror posts. I saw that a documentary on it, and it seems great. There was a thing coming out of Orange County that had Butch Patrick and then a chesty Elvira kind of woman introducing stuff, but I was not really around for that. I was really not around for the era of local television showing films at all, with the notable exception that they showed Big Trouble in China a lot as a kid.
I love that movie, I swear.
Yeah, which is one of my favorite films.
Oh,
but
yes.
It took me a long time to get around to it, because on the commercials for it, when they would say, you know, Big Trouble in Little China up at 6 p.m. after the local news, they would show the bit where the wind god would get big and explode. And as a kid, that just scared the crap out of me.
Well, yeah, I can imagine.
So I didn't come to the film until a while ago. Mm-hmm. What, 5-6 years ago when I saw it? I actually saw it, I think, like in the New Beverly, which is a theater here that Quentin Tarantino owns. It shows a bunch of old films.
I don't think I ever saw that in the theater. I always saw it on TV, and I got the DVD of it. And
it's great. Actually, there's been a few places that they've shown John Carpenter's films on the big screen, and then he speaks after, and that was one of them. I whenever they do one of those things, I have to go to it. So,
well, I would too. Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah.
See, that's one thing you and I have in common. I'm a big movie fan too. I worked in movie theaters two different times when I was in college. I was a assistant manager in one and projectionist in another, and I me and the manager in the first one I worked at, we'd split duties Thursday nights when the movies would come in. I'd get to put them together, and then we'd, you know, stay after and watch them to make sure the splices were good.
Awesome.
And I got, you know, always get to see the movies beforehand. And if the pay was better, I'd probably still be doing that.
Yeah, projectionist is an awesome art, and, you know, unfortunately one that's kind of threatened by so many theaters having to have to go digital, which is a big source of controversy in some places here. There's a cover story in the LA Weekly. And, you know, I think, you know, it starts with this crazy story. I'm looking at my DVDs of The Dark Knight and Batman Begins right now, where Christopher Nolan gathers all these directors for a preview screening of Inception. Guys like Edgar Wright, Duncan Jones, who did Moon and Source Code, other guys, not all British guys, but they're just the ones I can think of. And then he has them gathered, like the five families in The Godfather, and he says, like, we must fight this, you know, encroachment from digital, and keep, you know, 35mm alive. And, you know, I can see both sides of the argument.
Yeah.
But I do think there's something, you know, what I fear is all these, you know, smaller theaters, especially a lot of the repertory theaters, the extra cost that'll require them to go to digital.
Yeah.
And to the point where some of them, I mean, I've seen ones that, you know, they put up Kickstarters to say we need extra funding to go digital. Mm-hmm. It is one of those things where something seems easier or user friendly from the top down, but on a large scale. But then, and then when you get to the nitty gritty of it, you see how much, you know, how much work it does, which is one of the dark side of the digital revolution that we keep finding.
Yeah.
God. Yeah. I remember when I was, my wife and I would go to the Rialto in South Pasadena all the time when we were living out there. And, I mean, I'm looking online right now. I guess they've gone, you know, an 8-seat place or a screen place, but it was great. I mean, those theaters are few and far between, and they're so nice to sit in.
Yeah, the one I worked at was a 2-screen, and it was the first. It was actually, there wasn't any in my hometown. It was in Joplin, Missouri, is where it was at, and well, it's an Old Navy now. They totally destroyed it, but it was done. It was one of the first theaters in Joplin, and it was where I saw Star Wars for the first time.
Oh,
and
wow!
Smokey and the Bandit, I believe we saw that there, and it had two screens. There's like almost 300 people in each theater. And then to end up working there later on, you know, I mean, it was old enough that they had the platter system for putting stuff together, but I'm pretty sure they had it where they'd have to do reel by reel because there was a bathroom and a sink up there for the projectionists. So, you know, at one point I'm sure that it was like, you know, have a reel at a time and switch them over and all that other stuff. So, it's sad to see that. I saw my first ghost in that theater. That's another story.
Your first ghost?
Well, the only ghost, I guess you could say. But yeah, I was working there.
Are
late.
You sure you're not watching the film Ghostbusters? Because those ghosts are, okay.
Yeah, there are some ghosts in that movie. But yeah, there was rumors it was some people hurt or killed when they built that place. And
oh, really?
Yeah.
Because it used to be projection. You know, all the stuff that goes into projection was super dangerous because, you know, you had nitrate and all that. And
oh, yeah. We changing a bulb on one of those projectors we had, they were real old. I had to wear big thick lead gloves and blast visor and a lead vest or apron so you wouldn't be exposed to funky radiation.
Yeah.
Yeah, and all for below minimum wage, I might add.
Oh, really?
Yes. Well, the city manager had gotten a permit from the state to use an old 100-year-old law about if a certain percentage of your workers were students, then you could pay them below minimum wage. Everybody that was like 16, 17 years old were getting like $3 an hour or something like that. Of course, that was like 20 years ago or whatever, but, you know, and I was barely making $5 an hour as assistant manager. But yeah, oh, man, sometimes that I have there. That was fun.
Yeah, no, I've never worked in a theater, but I had friends that did, which gave me a lot of free passes into theaters. But,
Yeah.
Which apparently, I don't know if this is kind of inside knowledge, but movie theaters, it does not take a lot to get free passes from movie theaters, because I guess this is a bit of an open secret. They don't make money from you buying tickets to go see the film.
No, absolutely not. Yeah.
It's a bit like the direct marketing comics where they have to buy it from a distributor and then they're selling it to you.
Right.
But unlike comics where they, you know, retailers buy it from wholesale and then there's and then so they make their money back and then some whenever you buy a comic, they're buying these films for thousands of dollars. Mm-hmm. Your ticket is going back into them making that money back. The profit comes from the concession stands.
Exactly. Yeah.
So they'll give free passes all day if it means a second chance for you to buy popcorn or buy hot dogs or whatever.
Yeah, the way it was explained to me when I was working at the theaters is it was like, because there was another theater movie theater company in town, and we had a deal with them that they could go to any of our theaters to see our movies and vice versa. So, you know, mm-hmm. It was a list. Each one of them had a list of the other company's employees and if we wanted to go see so-and-so over there. But the way it was explained to me was it was like a lowest bidder kind of thing. You know, like they got this – so-and-so got this movie because they only took, you know, 15% of the ticket sale, you know, to pay for electricity or whatever. And whoever, you know, took the less is who got it basically.
Oh, wow.
But, you know, like I said, that was like over 20 years ago, so there's no telling what it's like now.
See, now I don't feel bad about sneaking in to see a second movie because I always buy more popcorn.
Yeah, there you go.
See? Yeah, no, yeah. That's what they want you to do.
Yeah.
Totally.
Yeah. That's why they're not too concerned about those tickets that they give you.
That's right.
Just go, you know, where sit wherever.
Ticket, schmick it. Buy some more popcorn.
Yeah, exactly. That. Yeah, the markup on that, on those – you know, because I used to have to do inventory all the time, and it was, it'd be like the cups would be like a dime to be made, you know, and all that money, that's where all that money came from for the movie theater. So, but anyway, wow, talk about dancing.
I do try to get concessions when I go to an independent theater like the Vista at Los Feliz, which is great, and it's where I choose to go see first run theaters and has great 35mm projection. It is something where it's like, well, at least they'll make money from this, especially since they only have the one screen. So
right. Yeah. I'm thinking. Let's see. The two screen I worked at is, like I said, an Old Navy now.
Yeah.
And the other one I worked at, I know it's closed. It might have got destroyed by the tornado.
Oh wow.
Sure. I'd have to go. I'd have to check. But
I did concession stand at in Westwood at one of the Mann theaters over there.
Oh, so yeah.
We could theater hop all day on our days off.
I enjoyed that so much. It was so much fun. Well, until the guy that hired me left and they got somebody else in, then it became a nightmare. But that's a whole nother story. That's a whole nother podcast, actually.
Old Navy Theater.
Tales from UC. You could do a podcast of tales of used to working in a theater.
Yeah, that'd actually be kind of neat, you know? We used to get in all kinds of crap, and it was like incidents with the film, and oh man, bad news. But anyway,
probably a lot of comic geeks have spent time working at a theater or a theater like a store would be my.
And ever since I always used to watch movies and stuff with my dad when I was a kid, but when I got that job, it was like that became like a passion with me, and that's why I have like you know. A gajillion DVDs and I watch movies every chance I get. It you know, the favorite ones you see 14 times or however many. I think I've seen The Magnificent Seven probably over 500 or 600 times.
Oh, wow.
Over the years. It was the first VHS tape and almost the first DVD I bought. But yeah, I used to watch that all the time. So.
Yeah, no, that's awesome. I still have a couple of old VHS tapes I keep just for sentimental value, I guess, of the Star Wars, because that's kind of the only way you can see the original Star Wars trilogy.
Yeah, I still have those two somewhere.
The ones with Leonard Maltin interviewing George Lucas beforehand. and then the 70s Invasion from the Body Snatchers, which is a sci-fi film. That's one of my favorite sci-fi films, and my favorite version of that.
With Donald Sutherland?
Yeah, Donald Sutherland and Leonard Nimoy.
Good Lord.
I was real little when I saw that. I'll have to see that again. That movie, that one scared me more than a lot of the other ones did.
Oh, yeah.
You're talking the trailer from Big Trouble in Little China with that guy exploding scaring you. They always show that scene where Donald Sutherland starts screaming near the end of the movie.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, that's I
could. Yeah.
Yeah.
It took years to get around to that movie just because of that.
Yeah, yeah. That was something else. And then I saw the original one after that. That was a totally different experience.
They do. We should get to comics sometime soon, but we also have to talk about the 70s version of Invasion from Body Snatchers. There's a part in that film where the Body Snatchers have taken over, and the guy who warns them, which I believe is Kevin McCarthy from the first film, there's a dog that comes out with his head on it, and that's never explained or anything. They never talk about, like, oh, they're also doing genetic experiments or whatever. It's just his head on a dog, and it's so random, which I go, that is nuts. When I lived in San Francisco, I was hoping to run into Phil Kaufman one day and say, what was up with that one thing? But I don't know.
So they never explained that?
Maybe if I get the DVD, there's a deleted scene that explains it, or I could look it up on Wikipedia, but I just have this VHS where I just have that one scene where you just have that one bit, and it's in stone, and just happened.
Jeff Goldblum was in that, too.
Yeah, Veronica Cartwright, who was an alien.
Mm-hmm. Leonard Nimoy. I forgot that he was in that.
Yeah. As soon as he said it, I had a picture in my head of it. That was weird. I haven't seen it. Oh, wow.
70s.
Robert Duvall was in it as uncredited priest.
Yeah, he's probably in it for like 2 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
there you go.
So he's Boo Bradley and an alien, all right.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Bradley, excuse me.
Interesting. Yeah, I'm going to have to watch that again.
I'll watch it with my 5-year-old and give her nightmares.
There you go. Yeah, see, now that's what's going to be great. And I was telling the guys I got a new job. I'm moving back to my hometown, and I'm going to be staying with my sister a little bit. So we've got 3 kids, 9, 6, and 3, that I'm going to get to. I've got all these movies I bet they've never seen. I don't think they've ever seen Star Wars.
My dad made me watch Star Wars. So, yeah, that's.
Well, we went right when it came out, and I watched it. Like I said, I watched it at that theater, and my parents always made sure I got to go see it. And so it was like the Indiana Jones movies I don't think they've ever seen, and there's so many other movies, which I'm going to have to clear some of them with my sister. I'm not really sure because she's just a little.
You're going to have this thing where Uncle Chris made me watch the movie about the shark is. Right.
But yeah, so, and of course all the cartoons I got. They're already looking forward to watching Batman Beyond, so.
Oh, yeah. The original Batman animated series is kind of, even more, even though I was reading comics at that time, that's one of the main reasons why my love for comics and my love for superheroes, certainly Batman, still remains, because I was, that was the typical, like, race home from school. I was in walking distance from my middle school at that time, and that was the one thing that I would definitely try to catch.
Yeah, because we didn't get Fox anywhere. I had lived until late, so it was towards maybe third or fourth season before I started watching those. But that's got to be one of the greatest cartoons ever. That and Batman Beyond, and of course Samurai Jack. It's just my opinion anyway.
See, when you say that, I think I used to raise someone watch Robotech. So.
Oh well, yeah, Robotech. I used to. They played it at. They play 2 episodes in the morning on Saturday, 6 and 6:30 in the morning. I don't know how I found out about that, because it was way before you know, the internet or any of that, or TiVo or any of that crap. And I think I just found it in the TV guide, and I got up just to see what it was, and it was right in the middle of the first, the Macross saga, I think it was. And so, yeah, from that point on, it was like struggling to get up in time. We didn't even have a VCR to record it even back then. Oh, man.
So Ian, was that your entree into comics, or were you already into comics when you were watching the Batman cartoon?
No, I was already reading comics pretty heavily.
See that segue?
That was good. I was going to ask that question. So.
That is a damn fine segue. I had been given comics now and then by my parents just to read, but I can remember the first. I can sort of remember the first two comics. One I remember very well because it's the X-Men number one by Jim Lee. That was the one I first bought with my own money, and then a Silver Surfer to go with it, from the Ron Lim era, if I'm correct. I was buying comics as a kid when Image was taking off, and so I was reading a lot of those. And there is still a soft spot in my heart for stuff like the original Youngblood, which, you know, I take it for what it is, but it's also tinged by, you know, happy nostalgic memories, Wildcat, Cyberforce. I do revisit that every once in a while, and those books have their high points and their low points. But I do, if you're a kid and you just need just a quick bash to the head of kinetic glory, like those do the trick like nothing else.
And
you know, also the fact that they were. I don't know. I'm a huge fan of a push to do all ages comics and bring kids in. But then at the same time, I realized when I was a kid, I wanted the books that were like older. Like you want something that feels like you've snuck into like an older kid's party or something like that. So you want the things that are some kids. Maybe some kids are good, but I was not good. Yeah. So you want something that feels. A little bit above your maturity level. So that was the big appeal. And then the Max comic and the Max cartoon on MTV were on at the same time. Max. And those were Sam Keith.
Right.
Yeah. And that was a comic where I'm like, oh, you really gotta read and think about these things. And I was ready for it.
I think I only got one issue of that. I don't think I ever read that, but I know what you're talking about, yeah.
And then from there, DC – not DC, beg your pardon. Dark Horse did their Legends line, which it very much, you know, influenced by seeing the success of Image. Mm-hmm. And there you had Hellboy. You had Madman. You had
Monkey Man O'Brien.
Monkey Man O'Brien, which didn't read until later. But you also had Big Guy and Rusty the Boy Robot.
Mm-hmm.
And Jeff Darrow, which is one of the most influential books in my entire life. And it was a book I still love a lot. And everything Jeff Darrow does is something that is a reason for me to check it out. So, you know, it was that kind of stuff. I was also still reading a lot of Batman stuff, especially because of the cartoon and the Batman Adventures tie-in comic. And then always a lot of Spider-Man and X-Men too. I should say the X-Men trading cards were what got me into X-Men and Marvel, just because you had all the information, and it was a real easy way to get into that world in a way that hit the collector itch that I think a lot of kids getting into comics have. Yeah. And then also just the information is all there. And that's a good primer to getting into the comics.
I got heavy into that too around that time, and I got all that stuff. I don't know. I eventually got rid of it. I think I sold it in yard sales and whatever. But yeah, I back in that time frame, I was probably buying everything.
Uh-huh.
You know, I didn't really get. I got into some of the Image stuff. Of course, you know, they couldn't ship on time most of the time. But
no, yeah, yeah.
But
it was affordable. I mean, not to get into, you know, not to get off on another tangent, but you know, you could say, yeah, I'm going to buy 6 or 7 Marvels. I'm going to buy a couple of these Images, maybe some DC, Dark Horse, and you know, it wasn't going to break your bank.
Well, yeah, and it was a collector's craze too. You know, oh well, I'm gonna go to college on how much this thing's worth, you know.
Yeah, I didn't think about it. I mean, I was into collecting things as into – I was into amassing a lot of stuff and amassing a lot of knowledge that you could impress your friends with. I would be jealous of guys who had comics before me or knew things before me, so I would have to beat them. But I should say I never kept anything in good enough condition to – and now I just get trades of the stuff I used to love. So
yeah, I've actually been doing that with because I never did. I read Spawn up to a certain point and I quit, and I never did read Savage Dragon past maybe the first issue, I think. And I found some trades on eBay of those recently. I've got 3 or 4 trades of Savage Dragon. Like I got them for like $5 or whatever. Mm-hmm. And that's actually pretty good stuff. I plan on picking up more of it later on. I got like the first 3 trades of that they redid of Spawn.
Now, Ian, the Big Boy and Rusty, the Boy Robot, didn't they do a reprint of like a giant oversized reprint of that?
It was always oversized.
Oh, was it always oversized? Okay.
Yeah, it was always like the size of like sort of a little bit smaller than a Marvel tabloid. Like also, if you've seen those.
Yeah.
I mean, his artwork is so detailed, it's like, that's the only way you could present it. So it's always been, I guess, the size of, like, a record album.
Yeah. They also did a cartoon of it, too.
Yeah, I've never seen that. But
I actually got to see if, that's where I saw it first. I didn't know what it was based on until years later. But, yeah.
I saw it actually down into San Diego many, many moons ago, one of the cartoon episodes, so. Mm-hmm. Jillion years ago.
Yeah, it's actually a pretty good cartoon. The art that they had on it was very reminiscent of the book from what I've seen, just a little bit, you know, a few pictures that I've seen, so.
That's cool. Darrow, he used to work in animation for a long time and can tell you stories about, like drawing, like, Scrappy-Doo and stuff and how much he hated it. So I guess I don't know if he worked on the cartoon or not, but he'd be the guy to.
Huh, interesting. Track him in.
You mentioned trying to get into comics that were maybe more mature than you were maybe mom and dad would have said okay to. But do you try and keep that in mind when you're? I mean, again, I'm trying to segue a little bit here on your bio. When you were doing when you're doing Chip and Dale or you're doing Darkwing Duck, what the Pixar people do? Do you try and aim it to all audiences rather than making it when they say
the Pixar reference is a good one because I definitely thought that my approach should be like Pixar, like Tintin, like Bone. It would be like, okay, can this appeal to everyone? Can this basically, can I get to the core of these stories in a way that gets to everyone, which I think is certainly the Pixar way. It's not, you know, it's not about adding things that kids would love as much as it's subtracting everything that would keep a certain audience out. So you just have the thing that would bring every audience in is definitely that was big in my mind doing those books.
Because it's really important to me when I love reading comics with my kids. I mean, we actually, my youngest who can't quite read yet is just getting there, but we have sat down and read one of her favorites to look at is actually a Darkwing Duck. comic. I honestly couldn't tell you whether it's one of yours because this thing is thrashed and buried in her bedroom, but I read it a few times. But, you know, we love reading, like, Franklin Richards is one I reference a lot.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Because it's very all-age. I mean, when they say all-age, it really is. There's little ins for everyone. I think that's great. I admire that you're able to say that you actually make an effort for that.
Yeah, that's something that I'm going to look at when I try to – you know, I've already got my nephews started on it. I got somehow along the line my oldest nephew became a Flash fan, so I've been giving him showcases. The first two, and he reads the crap out of them. And I finally able to give him a copy, which, you know, there was a lot of R-rated stuff in there, but one of the comic that's got the story that I wrote in it, he finally got that when I went down to vacation. So he was reading that a little bit some, so he seems to like him.
I thought you were going to say Sin City for a minute there.
No, I might wait till he's 10 before I give him that. So.
Yeah, exactly. That's the right age for it.
So, yeah. Yeah, I'm going to – that's kind of – I'm just going to – I'm looking – because, you know, I was just thinking about that today, just looking at the stuff I've got on Comicology. You know, like I bought – they had for sale the Strange – what was the name of it? The Strange Talent of Luther Strode.
Uh-huh.
Have you ever – is it – oh, man, is that bloody. It's like, yeah, I'm going to have to take that off of there because I was letting them play with, you know – tablet that I had, and they were looking through some. I found looking through some of the. I'm like, maybe you shouldn't look at that one. You know, some of those are okay, and some of them, like that one, is something you definitely don't want, especially the 6 and the 3-year-old looking at. The sister might beat the crap out of me, and she can do it too. She's 6'2", so.
Oh, wow. I defend the whole thing, Chris. I watch Family Guy with my kids. So
see, I know. I know my sister hates that show, so I won't be watching that.
It's some babysitting nights.
Yeah, well, so, you know, that's what I'm thinking, because, you know, now I'll be there, and she, you know, it's to go out on a Saturday, and it's like, it's movie night. Okay, we're watching Big Trouble in Little China tonight.
That's ultimately is a film I think kids can't.
Is that
PG or that's PG-13? That seems like.
That might have been before PG-13 was even invented.
It would be PG-13. I mean, you look at a movie like Green Lantern or Avengers, and those are PG-13, and it's the same type of violence. It's cartoony violence.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
There's not much swearing in it. I mean, I think maybe he says damn a couple times. And that's probably about as extreme as it gets.
Yeah.
Well, that's not true. There's a couple of shits in there, but that's about it.
They my sister's a tad bit more religious than I am, so we'll just have to work around that stuff. So I'm going to have to tone down my language a lot. But it's going to be fun showing them that stuff that I know they have never seen before. And so I'm looking forward to that.
All right, so the looking at your bio again, I mean, it seems like you've had your finger in a lot of the licensed products at Boom.
Yeah, I was going to ask you that. What's that like writing, or according to ComicDB, it was editing anyway, the Farscape?
Yeah, I was editing Farscape, Planet of the Apes, 20 Days Later, a lot of stuff with Foss, a lot of stuff with Farscape. That's and started with like the Warhammer stuff.
Yeah.
That was, It's a good education in basically figuring out in trying to please all parties.
I'm sure it
with,
is.
Which is possible, or at least you know.
Yeah.
As possible as can be, where you're finding something that makes for good comics and then makes for stuff that makes the licensors happy. Luckily, I've had pretty good relationships with most of the licensors who were open to open to a lot of creativity and a lot of the voices from the creators. In the case of Farscape, we had Rock Nias O'Bannon, who was the original, who was the creator of the show, working on the comics, so that helped a lot. So it was things were easier in that sense. Mm-hmm. But it was a lot of, it's just, you know, it's just like, you know, planning big productions and then,
yeah,
then getting all your ducks in a row, which
I thought those, I at the time when they were coming out, I couldn't afford to get them all, but I've been picking them up, you know, on Comixology when I can. But I'm a big fan of that show. And I thought they were great. So
they did really,
of course, you know, Rodney was doing a lot of writing, at least in the first bit of them. I thought they really captured the voice of those characters.
Yeah, no, Rodney and Keith R.A. DeCando, I think that was definitely a big thing about that. Both of those guys really worked hard on getting the voices down, which is something that you could lose when, you know, the actors aren't there. So that
exactly.
was
yeah.
something that they worked hard and succeeded at keeping.
Yeah,
are those stories part of canon then for them? I mean,
yeah,
does
they're like
I would consider them that, but I'm not sure what other people would.
It is in the terms of, you know, it's like when Joss Whedon does Buffy at Dark mm-hmm. Horse. It's just that, you know, the show's done in terms of television, and so here's the continuation of those stories, mm-hmm. and so this really gets to be, you know, what, you know, season five or so of that show.
Mm-hmm.
So do they kind of set the parameters for you, and then you're free to build stories within those parameters, or do you have to kind of bring the stories to them and then let them decide whether it fits?
It's always a constant back and forth. I mean, you'll talk to you. Eventually what I discovered is, you know, as great as it would be to just get like a Ten Commandments from them and then just go by that, you know, people, and I accept this and I'm fine with this, is that people won't see what's wrong until they see what's wrong. Mm-hmm. They'll want to, you know, go back and forth with everything, and then you just get everybody into the idea of like, hey, we're just figuring all this out together as we go along, and just if you have that approach to it, mm-hmm. where you appreciate the journey, then you're a lot better, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Did you run into that on the Disney stuff as well, or did you get a little more free hand with that?
You know, Disney stuff, I was just the writer for, so it was, and there weren't any really huge changes from Disney in terms of the stories that I can remember. So it was, you know, there'd be one or two points that would always help the story, I found, that. So it was much easier. I guess it was much easier because I was just writing. I wasn't bringing files back and forth or anything like that. And I found it, after all those years of editing, I found it, you know, easier to roll with the punches. Not that there were a lot of punches anyway, but
right.
A lot easier to just roll with that and mm-hmm. and just keep going.
It's funny. I mean, you should say. I mean, it just that you found it easier to be on the creative side rather than on the business end of it.
Yeah, well, I mean, it makes sense because, you know, the editor is more the in-between mm-hmm. the licensee and the writer, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's writing is – and also it's just – for me personally, this probably isn't everybody's story, but for me there is a bit of a thrill in writing all the time, so mm-hmm. – I enjoyed that. I got a lot of personal satisfaction out of editing, but there is something about that spark of creativity that for me is really important, and is why I just write now.
Yeah.
Did you always want to be a writer, or was it something that as you got sucked into the editing part, you go, gosh, that would be cool to put words on paper?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, did you seek out the editing part and then get into writing, or was it the other way around? Or?
No, it was always wanting to be a writer. That's mm-hmm. what I studied in college and right. what I wanted to be. I got into editing because it meant a job in comics. It meant
right.
Seeing how everything's done. It meant getting to know and work with people who did comics. Mm-hmm. And it was all that and more than even I can imagine. When I first started editing at Boom, thankfully, Ross Ritchie, the CEO there, and Mark Wade, who was then the editor-in-chief, were very open to me contributing to Zombie Tales, which was one of their horror anthologies. And that was, like, even my first week there, I said, I sort of have a story idea, and they were into it. And
that's cool.
So, yeah, it was always something I... you know, it's the spark of creativity. When I say, like, you know, when I was reading comics growing up, I was always creating my own little ideas for comics and video games.
Right.
I mean, other kids around me were doing it at the same time, but it was always just something that I found interesting as well to do, and kept me as entertained as playing the games and reading the comics.
Right. So that kind of leads me into a question. You know, people that listen to the show know that, you know, I'm a big Mark Wade fan. What's it like to work with him?
I think Wade is great. I mean, having him as my first editor, I got, you know, even for, you know, that first story, which is just 5 pages, you know, I got great tips on how to make things accessible and clear to an audience that I've kept with me. And then, you know, seeing him work and seeing the fact that he's got storytelling down so clear,
right.
And it's almost like this very instinctual thing for him. You know, there's not a lot of, at least when I saw, you know, was a satellite around, you know, stuff like Irredeemable Incorruptible. I didn't edit those books, but I was around them. Mm-hmm. You know, there's not necessarily a lot of outlining. And which is not necessarily a good or bad thing. It's just everybody has their different approaches. And the fact that right. he has an approach that's so in the moment is something that I think is the most satisfying way to read, because it brings a vitality to every panel, every line of dialogue. Mm-hmm. It's the stuff that I...
I'm sorry, I apologize for interrupting, but what do you mean by in the moment?
Yeah. I don't know. There's some stories where you can feel that there's a grand scheme going, and sometimes every character feels like a chess piece on a board, and everything that's being done, you have to say to yourself, oh, this will mean something later. And again, I've read stories like that have been ultimately very satisfying.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel there's a great human element where I feel in Wade's story, you know, they're not playing for the ending. They're not what they're saying now matters now, because that's, you know, it feels like that's what the characters all have in mind, as in real life. You just know right. what's happening now. You don't know what's happening around the corner. And when, you know, that is such it to me is such a great feeling of propulsion to those books because of that. And a great feeling like anything can happen. That's something I still really, you know, really enjoy, the fact that guy, you know, and also he's just, in terms of having clear, accessible stories, you'll notice, like, in his Daredevil, you can say he doesn't have to do this anymore because we have recap pages and back issues available online, but he still does kind of little recaps inside every issue.
Yeah.
Whether that's just narration. And I've found, like, you know, that is at this point, certainly definitely a deliberate choice. But when you have that happening actually within the story, as opposed to something outside the story, as opposed to something, you know, that's not part of the actual reading experience, you lose a bit of, I guess, yeah, I want to say the vitality, or you lose the reading experience, I think, becomes a little less robust, whereas in his stories have everything covered, I feel.
See, that goes along. I've said that many times on here before is I've never liked recap pages. I think, and he it's like you said, what he does is in his Daredevil, I agree that he does it to a point where they don't really need that. And I think somebody that's a good enough writer should not use that as a crutch. But, you know, also, I don't know. That's just my opinion. I know that Caleb especially doesn't agree with me on that, but
oh no, no, I don't. Don't get me wrong. No, I'm always of the mind that every issue is potentially someone's first issue,
right.
Waiting a couple others out there. You know, Bendis is probably another one, despite his wordiness, that's really good about. They're really good about saying within the story, rather than there is a recap page, you got that, but within the story, you still get all the pieces that you that are necessary for that particular issue. But what Chris is referring to is that I'm a fan of the new DCU stuff, but God help me if there's ever a group of comics that need recap pages or previously boxes.
Yeah, unfortunately, that which I think. Especially what kind of the info that's come out to light recently is that's an editorial problem, I think. They're so heavily editorially mandated, I think that's why, in my opinion, anyway.
No, but again, I am wholeheartedly behind if a writer can organically work in what happened before into the story, by all means, do it. You know?
Yeah, I mean, with in ways Daredevil, it always feels like it's coming from Matt, and you're seeing his take on things. It also does help ground. You know,
right.
You have to remember that especially if it's someone's first comic or someone's very early on in the comics reading game, that they can feel a bit out of place, like they don't know what's what. I've heard people say they don't know which panel to go to, whatever. That's something that, especially because it is happening in captions, which is the closest to prose or the closest to reading stuff online.
Right.
That helps ground a reader instantly. It's Peter Pan extending the hand to Wendy and then her grabbing onto it and then going for a ride. I mean, that's. You want something like that in a story, so as long as it's inviting, and as long as it you can read these classic 60s, 70s Marvel comics, which I still love. But yeah, I still read Claremont's X-Men all the time. That's a book that that's a writing style that's pretty much imprinted on my mind.
Mm-hmm.
And you can go like, there's a whole, especially when you read them in like essentials and you're like, there's a whole page just going over what I just saw. You can tell when it's just blocks of text, but, which is not diss on those books because there's a lot to, I still love about those books. But, when it has the character voice down, then you know it all has to go into flow into character development, which is something he can do for days.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I who I forgot to mention is actually one of my favorites. That is Peter David. His X-Factor is the understated book right up there. I mean, it ranks up there with Daredevil in my opinion. Where I could in fact hand any issue to someone and say, hey. Try this as your first comic, and they would be cool with it. They go, okay, I know the voice, I know what, because they both are really good at not overcomplicating the characters, but at the same time, if you've invested a lot of time in the book, you can see that the characters actually do have depth.
Oh, yeah, and I agree with you. Peter David is one of those kind of people, and Wade, I've always felt like his characters have a level of depth that not every creator out there can do, that's just, I've always felt that way about him. Like, especially you read his Empire or, a couple others. I'm fanboying now. I apologize. I'm just such a big, I actually got to meet him, I don't know, maybe 10 years ago. And I don't know. He's just really cool.
Yeah. Yeah.
But
so you're getting a chance at Ed Boom again, as I segue off a little bit.
Yeah,
back on track a little bit, teeny bit, Freelancers.
Yeah, you mentioned that.
Something that you're getting to do all 100%, all Ian Brill all the time for Boom?
Yeah, that's a book that was created by Matt Gagnon, who's the editor-in-chief now, and Felipe Smith, who did MBQ at Tokyo Pop, who did Peepochu, is his book that was done in Japan. He's one of the few Western artists to become a mangaka in Japan and create, write, draw his own books there, which is a rarity, and I believe that's the first time it ever happened at that sustained level. I mean, he has three volumes of it now in both in Japan and America, and, you know, he was doing chapters of it weekly in magazines. Back when Matt was the buyer at Meltdown Comics, him and Felipe, who was living in Los Angeles at the time and is back here now, created this idea of two female bounty hunters who were raised in a kung fu orphanage.
I'm
something
sold
that,
already.
Yeah, no, it's such a fun little world to explore. And so they wanted to bring that back. Matt was, you know, is EIC at Boom, and Felipe has a lot of stuff going on. They'll oversee it, and Felipe is doing covers, and we have all his, you know, character designs, and I have Matt's kind of whole plan for, you know, all his character bios and stuff. And so then I write it, and Joshua Covey draws it, and he is amazing. He is amazing at both action and also great facial expressions, which I really appreciate and is a huge help for me writing these stories. The fact that I can get to have the characters emote not just with a bunch of dialogue, but also just with their faces is a godsend. And so we get to do these stories, and it's something where we try to pack in a lot of story for each issue, but you can see when there's giant longer narratives going throughout the series a bit. I mean, this is how I think most books should approach things now, when we're living in an age of, you know, books are, they have to be $3.99, and sometimes you're only getting up to, like, you know, 20 or 19 pages. I look back to 70s Marvel, 80s Marvel, where you had a lot of stuff going on. Mm-hmm. But there were definitely strands that kept going, but you definitely had a feel of a third act structure, that something changed from beginning to end. And so it's stuff like, you know, Roger Stern's stuff on Spider-Man, or going back to like Tomb of Dracula, all these books where there's long narratives going, but you still have a feel of every issue is its own event, is something I like to approach as much comic story as I can, but certainly this stuff. I get to have, you know, place the stories all around Los Angeles with these two characters, Gas and Val, who play off great against each other and have a lot of, you know, big crazy characters to have fun with.
Cool.
Let me see if I got the structure right. They're basically that each issue is almost a done in one, but there is a through line as the series progresses. Is that
yeah, right? There's a bit of a whole meta narrative that you'll definitely see played out, a whole kind of longer mystery. But in that, you'll see kind of a complete thing on its own, or at least that's what we're shooting for, at least as best we can.
Is this an ongoing, a mini?
It's an ongoing. I mean, we'll keep doing it as long as people keep buying it, you know, like anything else.
What, they won't support it? Okay, I get it. I see how it works. It's a profit-making scheme. Okay.
Yeah.
Yep, one of those.
Okay.
Well, I was going to ask you something about the writing process. Do you ever get writer's block? And if you do, you know, I've heard some people say, well, they don't believe in writer's block, but, you know, Because I've done some writing on my own. I've written a tech book, and I got like one comic story out there. But, you know, what do you do about writer's block? If you get it, or if you believe in it.
I don't think there's writer's block. I do think there's writer's exhaustion, where you feel like you've for that day you've played in that world and harnessed those character voices enough for that one day. But especially nowadays, I feel like everybody has multiple projects. Certainly, I do. Mm-hmm. You just jump from project to project,
right.
And then trying, you know. Constantly playing with those different flavors gives you enough dynamism so you never feel too just blocked. And also, you know, my writing process is really informed by, I should say, having a short attention span. So
I know what you mean about that.
So if I'm ever bored, I know it'll mean the reader's bored, so I do something that doesn't make me bored. I mean, for example, Stephen King in his book on writing.
I need to get that. A friend of mine has been reading it, and he really likes it.
Yeah, it's a fantastic book. He talks about when writing The Stand, he didn't know where to go, so he just had a bomb and blew up like half the cast. That's you're writing, especially if it's your original story,
right?
Writer's block is just you haven't come up with that great idea yet, and just go for it. I mean, just drop more stuff on the characters' heads, and then hopefully you have a good enough sense of those characters that the way they react to it will be stimulating.
Yeah, I think what my problem was is because I wrote you know a technical book, and there was a lot of stuff on the you know editor / company side that made it difficult, and ended up taking like 2.5 years to do. Uh-huh. And it, for a long time, I couldn't. You know, and I wrote a lot of technical stuff there for a long time. I'm kind of out of that now. But it just seems like I couldn't even write about comics for a long time. It was just such a mental, massacre, I guess you could say. it was pretty rough. So, but I've the first real thing I've written since then was that story I did in that anthology for the comics experience class I took. So I just kind of wondered because I've talked to other writers and some of them, they have like, you know, I do this, and I've read articles about that, and others say, well, there's no such thing as writer's block, which, you know, I just, that's something, a question I always try to ask.
It's, you know, I definitely know switching from the day job mentality to the, writing mentality, the creative writing mentality, I would say, you know, tell yourself that this is first and foremost a treat to yourself. You know, first and foremost, you are entertaining yourself. Mm-hmm. I believe in making things accessible to an audience. I believe in making things fun for an audience to join. But you can't second guess or write for an audience. And I'm not going to write something just because, you know, it's popular this week at the movie theaters, or it's the number one selling comic, and then write a knockoff of that. I don't think anybody really likes that stuff.
Yeah.
First and foremost, just write your favorite movie or write your favorite comic. Just write a comic you want to read, and then go from there. And never stop. I mean, I think people really respond to work that has a great sense of enthusiasm behind it and has a great sense of joy behind it. I think people can feel that a lot of the time. So definitely do that. Just, you know, whatever it is, just go for that. And also I would say, especially with comic scripts, there's no set format. And with screenwriting, there's programs that do the formatting for you.
Right.
I would say, Just write with just your id going and not worry about anything technical. That's what second drafts are for. That's what third drafts are for. You know, just keep going. I would say, like, don't even worry about, like, misspellings or grammar. I mean, fix those later.
Yeah,
of course,
that's one of my big problems is I'm always doing that as I write.
Yeah, but don't worry. Yeah. You shouldn't worry about – I mean, you're only going to see that first draft.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So just that first draft should include the soul of the project, and just do that, and then you know, then go back, fix everything in terms of technicality,
right.
And then show it to people. But your first, you know, there's the talk of like just like a vomit draft. You kind of need that for it to flow out of you, because you know that's why people write is that initial spark of creativity.
Mm-hmm. Do you know Josh Dysart by any chance?
No, I've seen him speak and I've enjoyed his work, but I don't know him.
Okay, when you mentioned the vomit draft, that's one of his favorite terms. So I was like,
Yeah.
Do you write full script or do you write Marvel style when you do your
I write full script most of the time, but I would definitely like to try Marvel style. I listen to Kieran Gillen's podcast. He had Wade and Fraction and Jamie McKelvey on to talk about Marvel style versus full script. And I definitely think there's a lot of you have to have you have to kind of already know the artist you're working for, which is not something that a lot of assignments will do for you. More and more these days, but it can definitely happen, and certainly I think on a lot of the creator-owned books where it's you and an artist starting off before a publisher's even involved, to do something where it feels like if you guys are on the same page already, then I think it can help in terms of, you know, the artist calling some of these, you know, it becomes a conversation between the artist and writer, and I think that can be a big help.
So you say that, and then correct me if I'm wrong, but are all four issues of your Dracula World Order, are they done by different artists?
Yeah, that was a choice by. Basically, it was this kind of weird thing where I wanted to work with all my the artists that I really loved working with as an editor and who I loved as a reader. Guys like Tonsi and Gabriel Hardman, Declan, and Rasan Akadel. Basically, I knew I could only get them for a little while because they're so in demand, because they are so, all of them, amazingly talented. So I basically went to them and said, could I get you for six pages? That book was put together for a long time, and so I gave these guys, you know, huge deadlines for little work just so I could have them contribute to my story. And then that was something where, you know, I mean, certainly that was done full script because I needed just this one bulletproof document that could go from everybody in it. And I sketched out the main characters myself just so there's a consistent design, amongst all the different artists. But, I don't know. I would love to try, if I have a great working relationship with the artist and they're into the thing as much as I would love to try a Marvel style and see, I would love to see, you know, have an artist come back with, you know, blocking and direction that's different than I would think of and then work with that. You know, I think there's a lot of cool things to do with that.
Do you have at this point, does it look like it's going to be a long-term relationship on freelancers?
I hope so. We don't know.
With the artist is what I mean by that.
Oh yeah. We hope so, but so early on in the process right now, and also, you know, there's a lot of back and forth between me and Matt because Matt's the creator. So full script helps for that, just so we both know what we're dealing with. That kind of helps for that process, but I don't know. We'll see.
That would probably sounds like an awesome opportunity for that.
Yeah.
Nice.
Are you still doing editing with Boom, or are you now strictly on the writer side?
I just write comics and maybe other things that come along. You know, there's been kind of some stuff going on in the role playing game world, but you know, we'll
that's cool.
Nothing that I can talk about quite yet. We'll see. But you know, just writing. Which is all I want to do, so.
Well, that's cool. Yeah, the times that I've been able to do it, I enjoy it too, so that's something I want to do more work on. So,
It's really cool. I mean, it's nice that you're in Los Angeles and all, but I keep reading these script writing books that talk about it's not as necessary as it used to be in LA to make it or break it. And I think that's extra true with comics because, you know, I constantly see people working with artists that are in the Philippines or in Europe or whatever, or, you know, Turkey or something. And, it seems like it would be, easier in that regard, but would you agree or disagree that
I think for comics it can be anywhere. I think for movie and TV, maybe not with movies, depending on what you want to do, but certainly for TV, being in Los Angeles is necessary. But comics, you can, and I think one of the big appeal is that you can do it wherever. Yeah.
God, I lost my train of thought. I was going to ask you something about your choice of artist, but totally slipped my mind. I should have jumped.
On DWO? On Dracula?
Yeah, I mean, you said already that those were the guys you wanted to work with. Did you tell them which pages that they were going to get, or did you just say, okay, let me know when you got time, and I'll throw you six pages?
It was a matter of first getting those guys involved. I had an overall idea, but not a full script yet. Then once all of those guys, and I'm extremely lucky that, you know, all my first choices for artists said, that I then took, I knew it was going to be four chapters made up of six pages each. And then, just coming up with tailoring kind of everything to those artists. You'll see that, you know, Tauncey's bit in the very beginning is very kinetic. And then, you know, Declan's bit takes place in this very kind of dark, moody place, kind of similar to some of the things that were done in 20 Days Later. You know, it was kind of tailoring everything to them, which was then a lot of which gave me a great advantage and was a great tool to help me just write in these different areas and take on different kind of challenges as a writer. So that was kind of the mindset behind that.
Now, why is there only a limited print run on this? And
Of cost, right?
Yeah, I mean, it was all I had to do it all myself, so, you know, it's completely independent, so, you know, it's, you know, as much as I thankfully I had a great printer with me, but yeah, there's only so much one man can do with, when it comes to printing and only so much one man can spend, so, it was that, and then, thankfully, also having the book digitally is a great advantage in spreading the word about that book, and then,
yeah, I can speak from that, just from that, you know, getting just the eight or nine of us together that did our little anthology that were in that class. I mean, it ended up, you know, I ended up spending $1,000 of my own money just, well, I mean, when you add the cost of the class in there to get it together. So I know exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah, but it was all work and capital I was happy to use because it is my own thing. But yeah.
Yeah.
Print on demand, or are you going through, like, I don't even know if Quebec or even exists anymore, but.
No, it was through a printer that works with a lot of major league comic companies that I had a relationship with. Actually, I live sort of near, and so I was able to work with them.
Yeah, I'm not too fond of Kablam anymore, that's for sure.
Oh, really?
Yeah, they pretty screwed us over big time. Mm-hmm.
And I see a lot of the shops that you dropped it off at are out in California. It looks like one New York, an Ohio, a couple New Yorks, actually. Oh, and look, up in Toronto.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, The Beguiling. Yeah, they're great. I love those guys.
Cool.
Murray stepped away. I was going to give him an opening there to talk more Canada stuff, but okay. Wow, so you got it all over. You got it here, there, and everywhere. I see. Oh, I used to shop at. I went to Collector's Paradise a couple times myself.
Wow. Oh yeah, they're great. Yeah, Ed's one of the he's one of the people who really convinced me to do a print version of it. So, yeah, I had a great signing there. So
nice. You say that. So was it originally just going to be digital?
For the longest time, yeah, I thought it would be digital. But, you know, print a way to make it feel to get it into, you know, more people's hands. So that was, you know, it was. That's the main goal, so to get in as many people's hands as possible. So that was just, you know, it ended up being worth it, so we went with that.
You can't take a digital copy to a con, huh?
Yeah, there's you know, there's stuff like that. I mean, you know, I wanted to service everybody's tastes when it comes to their, you know, shopping choices, which are, you know, there's so many now. So I figured let's hit as many as possible.
Do you read comics digitally yourself?
Yeah, it for me, it's when it comes to reading singles, I really like it. And then they'll go like get a print trade. That's usually kind of the way I go about it. You know, I still love Absolute Editions. I still love, you know, big Marvel on the buy. But when it comes to single issues, I think for convenience, digital helps a lot.
Yeah, because you know, I just got through doing switching over to digital myself fully, and I agree with you. I think that the getting the trades is if I buy a print, that's how I'll do it probably from now on.
Mm-hmm.
But yours was driven by the fact that your store was sucked.
Yeah, they sucked. They decided to start charging you for the right to have a pull box.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so I decided I didn't need to do that.
Yeah, right to have a pull box.
Yeah, no, seriously, I'm not kidding. That's exactly. I mean, they didn't say it that way, but that, you know, they're making you prepay. And then they'll
have the right to have a pull box.
Yeah, it's like, no. Because, I mean, I'd go in there and I'd give them a printed list, and 9 times out of 10 I'd have to get the stuff off the shelf, and there'd be the stuff that was in there. Half of it was stuff I didn't want. So, yeah, it's just accumulation of stuff, and I just, you know. No.
That story.
Well, and then, you know, I knew I was going to leave this town anyway, so I might as well, you know. But it's another story. But yeah.
So for the most part, your monthly fix is digital then.
It feels. Sometimes it feels kind of weird going out of your way to go to a comic store to get, like, just to spend $4 for 1 week. I mean, right. You know, my comic book reading is probably just about $10 or $15 a month anyway. I only read a few books. So then it's just like, let's you know, to have it all there on a device you're using all the time anyway, it means you have it when you're waiting in line, when you're sitting and waiting for whatever. It's the convenience is a big thing for me.
Yeah. The only reason I go to the store now is to get my kids' books. I get my the Legion and stuff for my kid, and you know, the occasional all reader stuff for my younger one, whether it's Scooby Doo or it's a, you know, a Darkwing Duck or something like that. That's it for me. I'm almost 100% digital myself. So
yeah.
It is much more convenient. I can take my whole weekly reading to work with me for lunch hour or whatever.
Yeah. I'm really liking it that way too. Now it's definitely a lot easier.
And also, because of Comixology, you can read everything on their site just through your account. Mm-hmm. So it's just another tab you can have open on your browser. I mean,
yeah. It's easier to get away with at work too, I feel.
Yeah. Yeah,
I mean, because you could be reading anything on an iPad or tablet, and nobody thinks twice about it. And I've actually been spoken to about actually sitting there reading the comic book, even though, you know, I've got 15 processes running. I don't need to be watching them, you know.
Yeah,
you know, 40 browser tabs with different things I've looked up, but you know, you're sitting there reading a tablet, nobody even thinks about it. So
Murray will be teaching his kids, but he'll actually be reading a iPad behind the desk. And
like, I will not. I'm still dead paper guy. I've got boxes and boxes. I read very little on my iPad.
Well, see, that's another reason why I switched, is all the boxes and boxes that I'm going to have to move 500 miles here in a little bit.
It sucks.
Yeah, but
I love the feel of it too. I mean, I still get trades and stuff because of that, and I do love. I have three long boxes with back issues that I go into. Mm-hmm. But I can see, like, I've been going digital for about a year, 2 years or so. And if I was buying all those things, I mean, for a while I got into the habit of just throwing out new comics that I was reading, just treating them like magazines or newspapers because...
Oh, man, you're killing me.
Well, I was a journalist before I was an editor, and I was being sent a lot of comics... and I greatly appreciated, but I was going to send a lot of stuff. I had no control over it, mm-hmm. so it wasn't always stuff I wanted to read anyway.
Yeah.
But you just get to treating it like a newspaper, like a magazine anyway.
I could see that.
Yeah, I don't bag and board the new ones I get anymore. And again, like I said, most of them now are going into my kids' rooms anyhow, and they don't know anything about treating comics with any kind of respect, especially. Especially since they know, you know, oh, well, I can go read Daddy's digital version if I really wanted to ever read it again.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah, that's another reason is bags and boards cost.
Yeah, it eventually just becomes I'll just go. Then digital looks cheaper because then you're just buying the comic.
Yeah, because I'm sitting there looking at my probably 40 plus boxes full. Right now that I'm going to have to, I about killed myself. I started my first day of packing yesterday, and I wore myself out so much I didn't get up to like 2:30 today.
Yeah.
look for a Chris Mosby page on eBay coming to you.
Well, I see that's the thing. I've tried that, and the market's so full. I'm just going to end up. I'll be taking all of them. The toys I wish I could sell. I got action figures all over the walls and stuff, but that's just I just don't have time. I just got to get the stuff packed up and ready. So
you know, a really good place to take a bunch of those, and this is no joke, is the local orphanage. I kid you not.
It's not a bad idea, actually.
Children's hospitals.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
they just love that kind of stuff because it's so hard to get those kids to read anyhow, and if you're throwing a box of Avengers at them, You're tricking them into reading.
That's a good
point. And you can get a tax write-off sometimes.
You can? Oh, yeah. They will give you a receipt. Yeah. Absolutely.
There you go. Yeah, this box of comics is worth $20,000.
Sure.
Right. Somehow
prove me wrong.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah.
Mr. Auditor.
So, what else?
So you've got Drag to the World Order going on. You have Freelancers going on. What else is? What else are we?
That's it. That's it for all I can talk about. There's other stuff, but I don't know if I can talk about it right now. So
are you done? So are you done with the all ages stuff at Boom then?
I don't have any all ages. Oh, I do have one all ages thing, not at Boom, but coming up. But I don't know. I like I don't know how much of that, just because there's not as much of those comics being made. But I, you know, I like writing in that vein sometimes. But you know, whatever, you know, there's one all ages thing going on. But whatever comes my way.
Could I share Freelancers with my 9-year-old? Would that be something that you?
I would say this is more like maybe 12 and up.
Okay.
I'm thinking of like that.
All right then. Sounds good.
All right. I'm just that's something that's important as a dad. You know, I want to be.
Yeah.
I think you had a couple of strong female characters there, and that's something I want to expose my daughters to.
I'm going to have to think more about that, too, as I'm around the nephews more. Probably the older stuff from the Golden Age and Silver Age, probably better start them off with it, and then pick up some other things they might like. But so that should be fun. And thank you for telling me about that Decompressed podcast. I definitely
That's a great podcast overall. Kieran has a bunch of interesting people to talk about the craft of writing.
Yeah, that's definitely something I want to – yeah, I'm downloading some of it now on my tablet, and I see they're going to talk to Nick Spencer on Morning Glories. Yep. It's something we're going to do one of our podcasts about that. And we just started reading it for the first time. I got the first two trades on Comixology, and that is the freakiest book ever, but I'm hooked on it.
Yeah, cool.
It's just odd.
So what do you read on it? You said you only read a couple books on a monthly basis.
Yeah, I was going to ask you that
too. Close it out and find out. Comics occupy your time on a monthly basis?
Let's see. For right now, enjoying Fraction and David Aja's Hawkeye. I think that is a great example of how to do to give you a lot of content in small doses, and make every book feel really make every book feel like it's its own thing, as well as being a piece of a greater piece. Really enjoyed Captain Marvel by Kelly Sue DeConnick and Dexter Soy.
I still don't know about that one, but yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, that's all right. I think what Snyder and Capullo is doing on Batman is great, and what Snyder did on Detective with Jock and Francisco Francavilla.
That stuff is awesome.
That's the kind of thing that reminds me of, like, when I was reading Batman the Animated Series, but then – or when I was watching it, and then kind of just, more like even bigger, more epic adventures. I pretty much read it in trade, but Fatal by Brew Baker and Phillips, pretty much everything they do, I really like.
I've got the first two issues of that. That's really good. I want to read some more of it.
Yeah, that's a great book. And then Casanova, whenever that comes back. I love that.
A lot of good stuff about that one.
What else? I'm trying to think here. I try to keep up with whatever Howard Chaykin's doing, because he is a major influence and I think a major, huge talent.
You don't think he's gone a little wacko on Black Kiss 2? I mean, that's way
over. I have caught up on Black Kiss 2, and I give that book a full thumbs up. That is a book that I'm actually I will say when I finished with that second one, I was both proud of the comics community that can exist. Mm-hmm. Like the fact that we fostered a world where a creator can explore storytelling choices such as those and is allowed to, made me honestly, like, that is what makes me proud to be American, and makes me proud to that we live in a country with a First Amendment. Like, when, like, the fact that can come out, it's like, that's what makes me proud to be American, is Black Kiss 2.
I haven't read that yet, but I'll definitely want to.
We'll do the quote poll for you and send it over to Chaykin. Okay, you and I can agree to disagree. I didn't get issue two. Issue one, I got just because I was such a fan of the original series.
I love it.
It's beautiful. I mean, I taking nothing away. Yeah. I mean, Chaykin in black and white. Oh my god. You should only work in black and white. Especially those heavy blacks that he did in there. But some of the content was like.
I will say the second issue, you see things form more, and maybe it feels like issue number one should have been like an issue zero, since it's so much of a prequel. But I think now that we're in it, the story, I'm like, yeah, I want to, it feels like that companion to Black Kiss that I wanted to read. So,
Maybe I'll.
You know, whatever. Hey, everyone's entitled to their own opinion. It's totally cool. And just to follow up with what I'm reading, I guess the battle for my two favorite books would be Saga by Vaughn and Staples, and then Daredevil by Wade, and usually it's Rivera and Salmi and guys like that.
Yeah,
that last issue though was pretty cool with All Red on there.
Oh yeah, 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 that was good stuff.
Or I guess he's doing FF with Fraction, so I'll look forward to that as well.
Yeah, I'll probably get that too.
That's gonna be weird with the Miz thing. Yes.
Yeah, that's interesting.
It's weird because I would say my favorite Marvel comics of all time is Fantastic Four 347 through 349. The Simonson, Art Adams, I say run of Fantastic Four. It's three issues out of Walt Simonson's larger run.
Yeah.
But that was during the short time where Sharon Ventura was the thing. So I'm all for like a female thing. I think is an interesting idea. So
yeah, that is interesting.
Briefly calling yourself Ms. Marvel, I think even.
She was Ms. Marvel, and then I don't know. Did she just call herself Thing? Because that was back when Ben Grimm could go back and forth. So one of the
when he was wearing the suit when he was wearing that goofy suit.
Thing. Oh yeah, I remember that. Oh, it's weird times, man.
Trivia I can pull, and I can't remember coworkers' names. Good lord.
Yeah.
Well, let's see. I think we've covered a good amount.
Thank you, man.
Yes, thank you for coming on.
Oh, thank you guys. It was a great interview.
Yeah, well, good. I'm glad.
This will go up when, Chris?
We'll go up this Monday.
Awesome.
Yeah, tomorrow. So
great.
As soon as I cut out the parts that were not fit for for listening, which isn't much, and throw our totally stolen theme song on the front and back, and it'll be up and ready to go. I'll have it ready in a little bit.
Very cool.
All right.
Thank you guys so much.
Yeah, thank you. Well,
thank you for coming on.
Yeah.
Anytime you feel like you want to pimp something, means reach out.
Absolutely. I was going to say the same thing.
Thank you so much for the invite. Thank you.
Yeah, sure. Anytime.
All right. Well, have a pleasant evening.
Yes.
You too. All of you guys.
Thank you.
Thanks. Thanks, Ian.
All right.
Have a good one.
All right, you too.
Good night.
Bye.
Whoa.
Hello?
Oh, there we go.
Is he gone? Yes, he's gone. Okay, good. That was good. Good episode.
That was good. That was a real good talk.
Yeah, I liked that.
Rui, you were so quiet, man.
I know. I'm a listener. I got caught up in what he was saying.
Yeah, he's, you can tell he knows his stuff, so that's great. What was I going to say? I think that's about it. You can give us your feedback at podcast@talesfromthelongbox.com on the Facebook page as well. And the forums is getting activity. You got a bunch of spammers been signing up. I've been battling them. Not that anybody's ever on there.
And if anybody, listening to this wants to know more, wants more about Ian Brill, he has, through Boom, it's all available, or Comixology, all of his stuff is available through Comixology.
Yeah, and he has, looks like he's got what's the word I'm looking for? He has a Tumblr page about some of this stuff, and you could ask him questions directly. I'll try to put that on the, pardon me, sorry. Try to put that on the show notes and all that good stuff. So,
So keep him in mind if you're looking for something a little different. His name is all over bunch of the Boom trade paperbacks that are out there. Yep. Maybe not necessarily as a writer, but definitely as a creative editor on there.
Well, I have to tell you that I really did like that Dracula World Order. If you haven't read it yet, go out $1.99. That's a good price for a good comic. So, the stuff.
All right.
That's about it.
I'm gonna go tuck my kids in now.
I'm gonna go call my parents back because they called about a half hour ago.
Okay. Hey, gentlemen.
Yes.
Hey, have a pleasant evening.
All right, Murray. You too.
Cheers. Murray,
welcome back to. the workforce.
Yes. Yeah. Welcome back.
Yeah, it's wonderful.
Lovely. All right. Talk
good
to
night,
you later.
Guys.
All right. Cheers.
Night.
Night.